Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio. This is International Women's Day, and this is a special I'm bringing you. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund, and the topic today is the rights of Mother Earth, Gaia, and the struggle of Indigenous people to stay on the land. My guest is Vandana Shiva. I could not have had a better guest for this topic or for this day. This remarkable woman is one of the most influential scientists leading the movement to save Mother Earth from the damage caused by those still intent on stripping her of her resources for private profit. She got her bachelor's degree in physics, her PhD in philosophy. She's an author, environmentalist, an ecofeminist, and a philosopher, and most importantly, an activist on behalf of Mother Earth. In 1991, she founded Navdanya. She is a tireless activist through this organization, working with tens of thousands of small farmers in India. They have managed to establish over 30 seed banks, conserve over 2,000 varieties of rice, and, of course, much more. So it's my great pleasure to get to say, welcome back to KBOO, Vandana.
My pleasure, too.
Well, today I wanted to talk to you about the rights of Mother Earth, and I know I got you up really early to do that, so thank you for joining us.
No, it's a pleasure. Pleasure to be talking to you on...
For International Women's
International
Day.
International Women's Day, which to me should be celebrated as the rights of all mothers, including our Mother Earth.
Yes, exactly. I thought it really was a perfect day. Now, last April, at the People's World Conference on Climate Change in Cochabamba, Bolivia, there passed a resolution, the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth. This was a really important event. It didn't get near as much publicity as we would might have wanted, at least in the U.S. media. Can you talk about this declaration and its importance?
Well, the declaration really came out of the failure of the Copenhagen summit. No environmental summit had had as large a gathering of heads of state as the Copenhagen Climate Summit. Yet it was subverted. The international legally binding treaty was replaced with a non-binding Copenhagen Accord. And that's when President Evo Morales of Bolivia said that this conference was supposed to have been about the rights of Mother Earth, not about the rights of polluters to continue polluting, and committed himself to have a gathering of willing governments and people and citizens from across the world. The Universal Declaration on the Rights of Mother Earth was not just a declaration that came out of the conference held on Mother Earth Day of 22nd of April last year, but is intended to be a sister declaration which finds its way into the UN finally to complement and supplement the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. Because we are at that moment in our evolution, in the evolution of the human species, to recognize that most of our basic rights, the right to food, the right to water, the right to shelter, all of these depend on the earth providing us the water and the food. And therefore, human rights are now predicated on the rights of Mother Earth. And unless we protect Mother Earth, we'll never be able to guarantee the human rights of the majority of the world's population, and we will have a handful of human beings acting as predators on this planet, destroying the planet and depriving the majority of a share. So it is combining human rights and the rights of Mother Earth, and I'm part of the group of people that the Bolivian government has chosen to move this declaration to communities, to people. We've translated it into local languages. Every time there's a major mobilization in India, I let people know that what they're fighting for is enshrined in a draft called the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth.
Well, and let's talk a little bit more about the insides of that declaration. One of the things that it talks about is that it calls Mother Earth an entity. And I wanted to ask you about that. You know, there's a lot of variety of opinions about the term Gaia and what does that mean. And it means different things for different scientists and then obviously for different people from a spiritual outlook. But talk about how do you mean that we, as, and I think I know how you mean, but I'd like to hear it for our audience, that Mother Earth is an entity that has rights inherent and integral to it.
Well, you know, a few centuries ago, a handful of men, and they were men, decided that the exploitation of the Earth required that nature be treated as dead, inert matter, and that value is given only when that matter is exploited, when minerals are mined and forests are logged and rivers are dammed. It's the human action that creates value. The earth is dead. She's not living. Before that, all societies recognized the earth as living. Women continue to recognize the earth as living. And indigenous cultures have continued to see the earth as living. A few decades ago, scientists like James Lovelock, who had worked for NASA, did research and modeling to show that the Earth creates her own conditions to be alive, and the Earth is alive, which is why he named her Gaia after the Greek goddess of the Earth. Basically, more and more scientists are recognizing that the Earth is creating life on this planet. She's vibrant, she's living, and that self-organized capacity to create life and maintain life and renew life is what makes the Earth an entity, a subject, a living being.
Yes. One of the things that I find particularly interesting about this is how those who still cling to not seeing the Earth this way, it seems pretty apparent to me. I mean, if I look at the veins in my arm, if I put poison in that veins, it's obviously poisoning me. If we poison our rivers, isn't that poisoning the whole Earth, including all beings, including humans? I can't see the logic that allows people to still act as if we're separated and divisible from the rest of the planet and somehow greater than the whole. Without the whole, we're not here.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's actually the power of worldviews and the destructive power of the mechanistic worldview that took life away from the Earth and allowed us to view ourselves as separate and allow those who have power to view themselves as not just separate but above the earth and having rights to destroy, to exploit, and convince themselves that they were somehow doing a favor to the rest of us by destroying that which maintains our life. And that's what allows corporations to have the kind of power they do, to trample over indigenous people's rights enshrined in constitutions like our constitution in India. And say no. Right now, the global appetite for minerals is so high, and it's high because minerals are commodities on which betting and exploitation is taking place, and all the Wall Street players who brought down the entire world's economy with speculation, who created the subprime crisis, are now betting on the price of aluminium, on bauxite, of iron ore and steel, and pushing more and more exploitation and pushing more and more destruction of the earth and the violation of the rights of people, and think that they have the right and are rewriting rules and laws around the world. And I was shocked when I found out that in the United States, instead of recognizing that the earth is a being, that the earth has rights, there's now deepening of a false assumption, illusion, a hallucination that corporations are human beings and their ability to corrupt governance by influence of money is their right to speech. Now, how much more insane can a society get?
It's like calling up
reality and construct a false illusion and lull yourself into believing that everything you do the earth to the earth, there will be no consequence.
And that is the way that most governments and most large corporations have been treating it. The thing that you brought up about our Supreme Court giving personhood to corporations, and yet the earth has no inherent rights to be protected, is an example of how far we've come from being close to nature. Now, when you talk about solutions for already damaged parts of our earth, and when you talk about working with the people around the world who, in fact, are facing the brunt of this, by the way, I want to let my audience know again that this is KBOO Community Radio, and I'm speaking with Vandana Shiva, environmental activist and author of over 20 books. When we're talking about this, talk a little bit more about how the solutions that you come up with, you talk about a paradigm shift when you think of Mother Earth as an entity. How are the solutions that you come up with for damage to Mother Earth or for preventing more damage different when you look from that paradigm?
Well, the first thing is when you see the Earth as living and you see her as a mother and you see her as having rights, then you have an obligation to prevent her destruction and destruction of her essential ecological processes that keep life on this planet. That's why the obligation, at least for me personally, to be an ecological activist, the moral, ethical obligation that I feel to join movements who are defending both the rights of Mother Earth and their own rights, and you cannot separate the two rights. Local communities depend on the forests that provide their needs. And we had a recent case in which I was very honored to be able to play a role. There's a sacred mountain of an indigenous tribe in India called the Dongri Akond, and they're a very ancient tribe. They've lived in that mountain for as long as history can remember. And they call that mountain their sacred mountain, Niyamgiri, the mountain that upholds the sacred law of the universe. For them, the destruction of this mountain means the end of the universe, their universe that they've constructed with the idea of a sacred earth. A company, one of the largest mining companies of the world, called Vedanta, a UK-based company, has been seeking to mine the bauxite in that mountain. And they had managed to corrupt every level of decision-making to get the approvals. But the local tribals had been blocking the mining from 2006 onwards. Last Environment Day, they invited me for a very, very big rally. And I made a commitment that till we stopped this mining, I would be there with them to fight the issue. So we created all kinds of events, conventions, got parliamentarians to see what was happening, got major decision makers to be aware, put pressure on the government to review its decisions. And in August of last year, the government was compelled to withdraw the approval for the mining for bauxite. We were able to establish that the bauxite left in the mountains, respecting the rights of the earth, played a bigger role, economic, ecological, social, cultural, than mined bauxite transformed into aluminium to be transformed into packaging to be thrown away into huge dumps.
That's a pretty remarkable victory.
There are vibrant movements around the world, and I believe that this contest between greed enshrined in fictitious institutions like corporations as having human personality versus the rights of Mother Earth and the rights of the people, that is the contest that will engage more and more people over the next coming decades. And I hope the outcome will be peace for the earth.
Now, you're just talking about an example of people who live on the land who have a very close relationship to the land being driven off by the greed of multinational corporations and the governments they can buy to do that. This is something that we see happening in really rapidly in many parts of the world. Can you talk a little bit more about how important this activity going on is, the struggle right now there on the land with people who are still trying to stay and live on it in a more natural way?
Well, the right of people to stay at peace with the earth, to be in their homes, to live in their ancestral homelands, is a very, very important struggle. It's important not just for the communities, who are fighting because they want to live according to their culture. They want to live in a place they see as home. And most people who got used to moving town to town, city to city, job to job, don't realize that for large parts of humanity, identity of what you are, who you are, comes from the earth where you belong, that particular mountain, that particular river basin. And for people who are struggling, they're defending their identity. They're defending their culture. They're defending their being. But I think the struggle is important for all of humanity, because this struggle is of people who know how to live without violation of the earth's rights. And if, as human beings, we are to recover our full humanity and move from the alienated, truncated humanity of thinking we are separate from and above nature, then we have to have teachers. We have to have those who recognize the earth as living and live according to her laws. And those are the cultures who are resisting the destruction of the earth. They are our teachers for the future. They are our bridge for the future. And we must therefore have solidarity with every struggle for the defense of the earth and the defense of the land and the defense of local cultures.
Vandana Shiva, last year in the United Nations there, shortly after actually the conference in Cochabamba, there was a resolution passed for the rights of people to safe drinking water and to basic sanitation. Talk about that and how important that is or not.
Well, interestingly, the resolution on the human right to water was also tabled by the government of Bolivia. And here's this tiny little country working to defend the rights of people across the world. In the initial stages, the powerful countries who support corporations owning the water and selling us water and privatizing water tried to block this resolution. But it is so obvious that everyone has a right to water, because water makes life. We are 70% water. Everyone needs drinking water. Everyone needs safe drinking water. The governments of the world have committed themselves to Millennium Development Goals. The seventh Millennium Development Goal is about the right to water. And yet, it was never enshrined as a human right. The resolution of last year in July is vital to now start moving towards ensuring that governments meet their obligation. But even more important, it is very important to not allow water to become a commodity to be sold and bought so that some people can have super profits. A U.S. trade mission has just been in India, and there's been massive protests in Bangalore, in Mumbai, where people are saying our water is not for sale. You can't come and tell yourselves, okay, India's drinking water needs could bring us profits of $50 billion, so we're going to privatize every city's water. So when a resolution is passed at the United Nations level, it gives governments both the right and the obligation to say no to such greed to commodify water.
Yes, the move to commodify water goes on here in Oregon as well. Nestle is trying to get water from a small stream that is essential to salmon near the Columbia River, and there is, of course, a battle going on to stop it. And that's happening all over the world, and I think you're one of the inspirations for that. You've been called an ecofeminist. Can you talk a little bit about the role of women in both saving the planet and in being the target of oppression within the planet related to the environment?
The first aspect of ecofeminism is, of course, to recognize that there's amazing earth, and she's our mother. That is a pillar of ecofeminism. The second is the recognition that the same forces that exploit nature also dominate women. It's the same worldview, the worldview of nature being dead, of women being the second sex. And thirdly, it is women who have been most active in defending the earth. When I got involved in the early 70s in this amazing movement of women of my region, I was still a student. Peasant women, never been to school, never been to university, came out and said, the forests provide water and soil and pure air, and you will not cut them. We will embrace the trees so that you will have to kill us before you kill the tree. The movement was called CHIPCO, which means to embrace. And CHIPCO changed the policies of our country for 10 years. Women said, these forests are our mothers. They give us life. And you cannot take our life away. Those kind of actions happen everywhere. In Bhopal, the city which had the worst industrial disaster in human history, when Union Carbide's pesticide plant leaked in 1984, killing 3,000 people in one night and 30,000 people since then, it is the mothers of Bhopal, it's the women of Bhopal who still fight for justice. They fight for protection. Everyone's right to clean water, clean air. And this connection between women and nature is not a biological connection. It's a cultural connection. It's a social connection. It's a connection created by the fact that women have been made to look after sustenance. And since the earth provides sustenance, when that sustenance is interrupted or destroyed, it's women who stand up and say, we need our water, we need our wood, we need our forests, we need our clean air, and we need it for all of our community, we need it for our children and all future generations. Of course, because they come in the way of exploitation, you know, they will be trivialized. In the case of CHIPCO, they were jailed. In the case of Bhopal, the strategy is ignore them. But I remember when the women of Love Canal, who were fighting against the toxic wastes that was giving cancer to the children, and women like Louise Gibbs organized and fought for their rights to have safe housing, they were called hysterical housewives. And they turned that into a positive thing. They said, if your child is dying of cancer, you will be hysterical. You'd better be hysterical, and you'd better get justice.
I love it when women take over movements like that. I was in Mexico a few years ago in the city of Veracruz, in the city of Jalapa. And there were women who every day stood out in front of the state capitol protesting the nuclear power plant that had been put in 5 years before. And they had been fighting this movement since way back then. And they had been facing lots of intimidation and those scare tactics, and yet there they would stand every day in the square with these huge signs. Totally inspirational, incredibly inspirational. And I think there's something that happens to us. We all have mothers and aunts and grandmas. When we see women standing out there making a protest, we know that that's not their initial first role. And it really makes us pay attention in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So you are not negative or pessimistic about the future of our ability to save the planet. And one of the things I saw in a debate you were doing was you talked about working with people who live on the land to develop resiliency. You talked about different kinds of seeds for different kinds of changes in the climate. And you talked also about adaptation and adapting to the changes of climate. Can you talk a little bit about those kinds of methods and how that's so different?
Well, one can keep saying no to what is wrong. But given that the greed of global economic power is so high, they don't care. They don't listen. They will only listen when people start to build another world. And that is why building alternatives is vital. I started Navdanya in the 80s, actually, and had it registered as a legal entity, as a charity, in 91. Navdanya means nine seeds. It's a movement to conserve diversity. And as climate havoc has increased, as cyclones come more frequently with higher velocity, as droughts increase and floods increase, we realize the seeds that we have been saving are seeds of resilience. We have seeds tolerate the salt that comes from the sea. Corporations are not inventing these traits. They're just stealing these traits from communities. We have the salt-tolerant, drought-tolerant, flood-tolerant varieties that are needed for resilience in the face of climate havoc. To have them in the hands of communities as a commons means every community can survive climate damage. To have them in the hands of corporations as patented varieties, which they will only provide when they are paid royalties, means the climate destruction is followed by a second destruction of privatized seed. That's why we fight very hard to keep these seeds in the commons and to save them and protect them and distribute them. But in addition to biodiversity, a second very important adaptation strategy is ecological agriculture. My book, Soil Not Oil, shows that we need to make a shift from the oil-based economy of fossil fuels to a soil-based civilization of resilience, adaptation, and renewal. The soil is where we can deal with the drought if our soil has enough organic matter. And I'm not saying carbon, I'm saying organic matter, because organic matter is living carbon. But you can have charcoal, which is dead carbon. And again, the industry would like to sell its pollutants in the name of biochar, when what the soil is needing is organic matter. We could remove 40%, 30% of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by increasing the organic matter content of soils. But in addition to reducing the climate damage, this also increases the resilience of the soil to deal with a drought, because soils with organic matter can hold much more water than soils without. Soils with organic matter can be resilient in the face of drought and floods because of this water-holding capacity. So biodiversity and organic matter in the soil are our two major adaptation strategies. But all of this comes from forgotten knowledge, which we need to bring back. And that's why we hold in Navdanya a grandmother's university to remember that which we cannot afford to forget, how to grow crops with little water, how to grow crops that need very, very little irrigation or no irrigation at all. And in addition to that, what we are doing is talking to communities, talking to women. We've just finished a study on women's traditional knowledge for adaptation to climate change. And the amount of wisdom and skills that are there, if only governments would turn towards elders, towards indigenous people, rather than turn towards scientists who would like to modify this planet rather than stop the pollution. You know, there is a whole lot of very, very eminent scientists who think engineering the planet is the solution. Put reflectors in the sky so that the sun doesn't come. Create artificial volcanoes, as if the sun was the problem. The sun is not the problem. Pollution is the problem. And those who pollute are the problem, and they need to change.
And I think we're going to have to end it right about there. I've been speaking with Vandana Shiva, author, writer, environmental activist. Really, you are a bundle of energy, innovation, and inspiration for our planet. I so appreciate the work you do. And thank you so much for joining us today and talking with us today.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. This is Linda Olsen Osterlund for KBOO Community Radio, and I've been speaking with Dr. Vandana Shiva for International Women's Day. Thank you for listening.